Welcome to Astounding Stories of Space and Time. I'm Wardell, and this week's story is The Undetected by George O. Smith. I took a quick look around the apartment, even though I already knew what I had to know. Gordon Andrews had been slain in his sleep by the quick thrust of some rapier-like instrument. There was no sign of any struggle. The wall safe stood with its door open and its contents missing. Every door and window was closed, locked, burglar-bugged, and non-openable from the inside. The front door had been forced by the police. Furthermore, it had been raining in wind-whipped torrents for hours. Yet there was no trace of moisture on any of the floors. Of course, no one had heard a sound, and naturally, there were no fingerprints. Police Chief Weston spied me and snapped, "What do you make of it, Chanel?" I shrugged and said, "Completely sealed room." "Got any ideas?" he demanded. I had a lot of ideas, but I was not going to express myself without a lot of stark evidence. I do not yearn to have the prefix X installed in front of my title of Captain of Detectives. I'm much too young to be retired, so instead of trying to explain, I said, "The modus operandi is," Chief Weston snorted, "Chanel, there isn't a clue in the whole damn building, and yet you stand there and yap about modus operandi?" "That's the point, Chief. The cluelessness is itself the modus operandi that points to..." "You talk as if we had a whole file of unsolved, clueless, sealed room homicides." "Chief," I said, "a true perfect crime would be one in which no clue existed, including the fact of the crime itself, except those clues that were deliberately planned by the perpetrator for some purpose of his own." He glowered at me. "What are you driving at, Chanel?" "I'm trying to convince you that we are faced with a very clever criminal mind," I said. "A man with a fine talent, one who plans his crimes so well that they aren't even recognized as criminal."
"Nonsense! You can't conceal any crime forever."
"Forever isn't necessary, Chief. Just long enough to cover up completely, to remove all connection. We don't know how many bank tellers have been running on reduced salary because they somehow paid out $100 in cashing a $10 check. We couldn't demand an audit of all the big financial accounts in town to know why and wherefore of the transfer of any sum of money larger than the limit of petty larceny." "But now you are talking about a sly, clever operator, Chanel. This is a plain case of homicide and burglary." "Plain? Was he kidding himself?" I smiled crookedly. "Chief, there's no doubt in my mind that our crook intended to clean out Gordon Andrews' safe without disturbing a soul, but the imminent awakening of Andrews presented a physical threat that had to be silenced immediately." "So, that's the work of your sly thief. Chief, just remember that Gordon Andrews was an eccentric old sourpuss who hated to do business with bankers. Now, let's suppose that Andrews had awakened in the morning to find his safe cleaned out. He screeches for the cops. We come a-roaring in with a fingerprint detail and the safe specialists and the break-in experts. We find," I said with a wave of my hand, "everything just as we found it here and now. So we look Gordon Andrews in the eye and tell him that no one could get in, no one had gotten in, and that we suspect him of cleaning out his own safe and yelling copper to make trouble for the mayor and the commissioner who refused to appoint him a special detail of city employees for bodyguards last year." "Go on, Chanel," said Chief Weston with deadly patience. "The homicide was a spur-of-the-moment necessity. Had it been planned, the crook would have plugged Andrews with the old man's personal banker's special, which he kept on the bedside table and made it look like suicide. Know a lot about Andrews, don't you, Schnell? What do you mean, Chief? About the banker's special. I have an excellent memory, I said. Andrews had a license for the thing. The serial number is 233-467-819, and the gun and license were acquired on August 7th, 1951. The chief sarcastically grunted. Has it been fired since? It was fired 6 times at the date of delivery by the police laboratory for the landmark records, I said. Let's not try being funny, Schnell. This is a serious business. Andrews was an eccentric old curmudgeon, but he was also a philanthropist, and the papers will be after our throats if we don't come up with this super criminal. He's going to be damn tough, Chief. Okay, this is your project. Nothing else matters until he's caught and convicted of homicide committed during the course of grand robbery, meaning automatic hot seat. I nodded slowly. Just remember, Schnell, the whole department's behind you, Chief Weston assured me. I continued to nod, but his assurance didn't reassure me in the least. With about 98% of the general public still not quite willing to accept rockets, missiles, and space travel, I had a fat chance of convincing anybody that a telepath had kept guard over the slumbering mind of Gordon Andrews while a perceptive solved the combination to the wall safe so that a kinetic could twirl the dial, that the imminent awakening of Gordon Andrews had indeed been an imminent physical threat to a delicate extrasensory undertaking, and that therefore he had been silenced by the kinematic with a weapon located by the perceptive after warning from the telepath, after which the crime had continued with the loot being floated down by a levitator along a freeway explored by the perceptive and scouted by the telepath and cleared of barriers by the kinematic, who opened and debugged them as he went along, and that the real topper for this whopper was that this operation was not the integrated effort of a clever gang of extrasensory specialists, but rather the single-handed accomplishment of one highly talented Psi-man, a Psi-man ruthless enough to kill before he would permit his victim to watch the turning dial, the floating loot, the opening portal, simply because there stood a probability that one of the 2 billion persons on Earth might suspect the phenomena as parapsychical activity instead of the hallucinatory ravings of a rich old eccentric who hated the incumbent political party. How best to keep a secret? Let no one suspect that any secret exists. The rain was still coming down in wind-whipped torrents that slatted along the avenue in drenching sheets. Huddled in the scant cover of the apartment door was a girl of about 18. The raincoat she wore was no protection. The wind drove the rain right up under it. Woman-like, she was struggling with the ruins of a fashionable little umbrella instead of abandoning it for the tangled mess that it was. She looked at me as I opened the door. She was without guile. She was wet and miserable and determined to take whatever help was proffered and hope afterward that no unfair advantage would be taken of the situation. I showed her my ID card and she read, "Howard Schnell, Captain, Special Detail." Her face changed from cautious immobility to a sort of wet animation, and she added, as if it were important under the circumstances to be completely open, "I'm Florence Wood." I took the ruined umbrella from her unresisting hand and stood it in the foyer for the janitor to dispose of, and pointed out across the rain-ponded sidewalk to the police car. It was almost high noon, but the rain was so heavy that the identity of the car was by no means conspicuous from the apartment floor. Florence Wood nodded as she caught sight of it. I said, "Now I'll make a run for it and open the door and get in first so that I'll be on the driver's side. As soon as I'm out of your way, just dive in and don't worry about closing the door until you're out of this rain, catch?" She nodded.
"I'd play Sir Galahad and give you my foul-weather gear to wear," I said, "but you're already so wet that it wouldn't do more than keep the water in." She smiled at me, understandingly. Then she looked at me with curiosity, because I was standing there waiting instead of making my dash immediately. I thought of how my Psyman could have floated the loot out of an open window and kept the rain from soaking the floor at the same time. So to make conversation, I said, "I'm waiting until my willpower builds up enough to overcome the forces of gravity, barometric pressure, and the rest of whatever goes into making a howling downpour like this. Considering that nature is dissipating energy equal to a couple of hundred atom bombs per second, it takes a bit of time to collect the necessary amount of mental power." Florence Wood laughed. In mere instants, she'd changed from weather-drenched misery to a cheerful sort of discomfort, no worse than many a human has endured for hours at a football game. She said with amusement, "Captain Chanel, why don't you start the car and drive it over here? Seems to me it would take less power than stopping the storm." "The law says that it is considered unlawful to operate a motor vehicle from any position other than the driver's seat," I replied. When the slack in the storm I'd been anticipating finally arrived, I took advantage of it to make my run across the sidewalk. Miss Wood followed. Her timing was perfect. Everything happened in a continuous sequence, without a stoppage at any point. The door opened, and I went in, landing hard and bouncing deliberately on the seat springs to hunch myself over. Miss Wood landed and whirled in a flurry of wet skirt and clammy raincoat, hauling one rain-booted ankle out of the way as the door swung closed with a solid and satisfying thunk. I started the car and let the engine idle to warm it up and dry it off. Then I said, "Part of my duty to the citizen includes protection of his health and comfort, as well as protection from unlawful behavior, so where do you wish to be taken?" She regarded me out of clear gray eyes. "Don't you know?" she asked with a quirk at the corner of her mouth. "Do I look like a mind reader?" "Well, you did slow down the storm." I laughed. "Miss Wood, King Canute would have been a hero instead of a bum if he'd waited until high water before he told the tide to stop. Now, what gave you any reason to suppose that I am endowed with special talents?" "Well," she said, fumbling through her handbag for the comb, which naturally was at the bottom, "you did come along when I needed help, and you did identify yourself when I wanted so much to know. And since I also remembered that storms as violent as this always have lulls, you put the two and two together. Well, it doesn't require telepathy to conclude that you are soaked to the skin, that you need and want help, and that you'd prefer to know just whom you are driving off in a car with. Any other ideas about my talents?"
"Well, I should think..."
"Address first, Miss Wood." She gave me an address in a residential district that was the maximum distance one could get from City Hall and still enjoy the privilege of paying city taxes. I started the car and headed in that direction. Then I said, "Now, Miss Wood, let's go on with your little fancy."
"Fancy?
You've been moonbeaming about a little courtroom drama where 12 good telepaths and true are reading the mental testimony of a witness who had located some vital bit of evidence by perception and brought it to light by kinematic power."
"Well, it does seem that any truly gifted person would work for the good of humanity."
"I doubt that being gifted with a sense of perception would automatically endow a man with a sense of honor."
"But doesn't it seem just awful to think of anything as miraculous as telepathy being used for,
she was trying to avoid the word immoral, because she was of an age and experience that felt sensitive about its use. Unfortunately, the only substitute was the word sin. I came to her rescue. It's deplorable, but true, that nothing was ever developed for the benefit of mankind.
without a few sharpshooters quickly figuring out some way to make it pay them a dishonest buck.
But it would be frightfully hard to bamboozle a telepathic policeman, wouldn't it? She asked hopefully.
I thought of my Psi-man, whose only mistake in the sealed room murder of Gordon Andrews had been in being so good that he'd actually disclosed the existence of a criminal who employs Psi faculties.
Oh, wouldn't that depend on whether the policeman or the criminal was the more talented? I parried. But that supposes that the police force would have a corps of Psi policemen.
Wouldn't they?
Honey, child, I said, at the first thin hint that the commissioner was even interested in the possibility of hiring someone who knew what the term parapsychic phenomena really meant, there would be a universal howl against thought police so loud it would shatter the polar ice caps.
But why? She asked, bewildered.
They'd start screaming about invasion of privacy and cite the Bill of Rights and... that would be that.
You mean that the law has laws against telepathy?
No, it doesn't say anything about telepathy, I admitted, knowing what was to come next.
Well, then,
don't sound so superior, Miss Wood. At the first attempt, the law would discover that it had a hell of a lot to say about telepathy and perception, since they definitely affect the interpretation of the Fourth and Fifth Amendments.
I know the Fifth, she said, but how about the Fourth?
Unreasonable and unwarranted search, I told her.
But isn't a man guilty when he's guilty?
I wish it were as simple as that.
But why isn't it?
Little Miss Wood, you are now asking me to solve an ethical question that's been unanswered for more than 10,000 years. I smiled wistfully. I am not big enough to answer the following question. Shall a killer in the confessional, who has been given absolution by his God, subsequently be punished by his fellow man?
But what has that to do with it?
Let's have you answer one. Could you... truly, bear your secret soul to God if you suspected that some prying human being was taking it all down on a tape recorder?
No, I suppose not.
Then our thought police would be standing as a human barrier between any man and his God.
I suppose so. But couldn't I tell?
Tell?
Tell whether someone was listening to my thoughts.
Well, that was another stumper. Does the sign wear out any faster if it's red? Can the radio transmitter be measured to tell whether the broadcast has any audience? Does the tree that falls in the forest barren of animal life generate the same wave motion as it would if all the leaves were replaced by active eardrums? Oh, there are a lot of analogs. But are any of them valid? I said. If I cry out, how can I know whether I am being heard? And in my mind, I made my own reply. I thought in deep concentration. How do you read me, Psi-man? The response was zero. Zero. And it meant nothing. My Psi-man could have been following my every thought from the moment that my ringing telephone summoned me to Gordon Andrews' apartment to the present instant. So far as I could tell, there was no feeling of intrusion, no feeling of presence. Florence Wood giggled.
Going to stop the rain again, Captain Schnell?
The storm was still howling. In the near suburbs, the rain came in more gracefully, draped sheets, and the wind was not as whirlpooled by the flue-like canyons between the buildings. But residential rainwater is just as wet per cubic centimeter as the metropolitan variety.
Maybe I should drive up over the lawn, I suggested.
Daddy would blow a fuse.
We might wait for it to let up.
"I'd rather not," she said soberly. "It's one thing to be driven home in a strange car during a cloudburst, but it's something else to sit out here making it look as if I were paying off by making out." It came as a pleasant surprise that she did not consider me a superannuated gaffer, and it was her youth that allowed her to discuss parapsychic phenomena without the tongue-in-cheek attitude of the older know-it-alls. I considered Florence Wood and realized that she was at least old enough so that I wouldn't be jugged for cradle robbing so long as I had parental acceptance. And I did want someone to talk out the business of psionics without having someone wind me in a sheet and ship me to a shrinker. And so I said, "If it will smooth things a bit, I'll umbrella you to the door and make official explanation to the stern and anxious parent." "That we'll enjoy," she giggled. "Daddy always says that he doesn't have to be a mind reader to advise against what my boyfriends have in mind. It'll be fun to face him with a policeman." Darkly, I said, "Most folks don't look upon me as the fun-loving type. Policemen aren't always welcome, you know." "Oh, Daddy will enjoy it. He writes a bit. He'll never be another Ellery Queen, but he will enjoy talking to a real live captain of detectives." At this point, a lot of favorable things took place at once, such as the arrival of another convenient let-up in the storm, the mad rush and the ringing of the doorbell, the opening of the door, and some gasped introductions as we stood in a little hallway, dripping puddles of rainwater on a small rug. "Police Captain Howard Schnell. But Florence isn't," I laughed at Mrs. Wood. "Not at all. This is just the rescue of a very wet maiden in distress. When we're not shooting bank robbers, we also help little old ladies and lovely young girls across streets, all in a day's work, you know." Mrs. Wood hauled Florence off, saying something about hot showers and dry clothing, while Mr. Wood regarded me with interest. He beat all around the bush, trying to ascertain, without actually asking point blank, whether I could spend a few moments, and if so, would I like a drink. One must not anticipate, so I waited until he'd made his meaning clear. Then I accepted his offer of some bourbon, refused his offer of a cigar, and settled myself into the chair he waved at. I tasted the highball, smiled in approval, and opened the conversation by saying, "Your daughter tells me that you write, Mr. Wood." He smiled wistfully. "Well, I'm not at the stage where the mere announcement that I am working on a novel causes an immediate pre-publication sale of 70,000 copies. You see, I'm still trying to work out a good association gimmick." "What?" "An association gimmick. The name Earl Stanley Gardner, for instance, always means a story about Perry Mason and the inevitable courtroom scene full of legal fireworks. Rex Stout has his Nero Wolf, the fabulous detective who lets his secretary do all the work. And," I added, "John Dixon Carr writes about Gideon Fell, who is an expert at solving sealed room mysteries." "Exactly," he said. "I have a series of gimmicks all planned, but I really need a strong, out-of-the-ordinary character to go along with them. You see, I propose to write a series of stories about perfect crimes." "I'm not smart," I said. "I've always assumed that the so-called perfect crime would be one in which the criminal walks off scot-free with the loot under one arm and the girl on the other." He said, "From your point of view, a true perfect crime would be one in which no clue existed, including the fact of the crime itself, except those clues that were deliberately planned by the perpetrator for some purpose of his own. That is your own angle, isn't it?" I nodded. Indeed it was, and it had been expressed in precisely the same words that I had used in speaking to Chief Weston. "However," he went on blandly,
You'll agree that a clue is usually the result of a mistake or a failure to plan completely, or the result of some accidental circumstance.
Right.
But in a perfect crime, there would be no error, no mistake.
Yes, but aren't you backing yourself into a hole that you've lined with fish hooks yourself?
Not at all, he replied. Clues must be cleverly contrived, created, and established in such a way that the episode is ultimately known to be crime and not labeled misadventure, suicide, or the like. Otherwise, he said with a genial smile, we're writing about perfectly justifiable homicide instead of a perfect crime.
I nodded again.
And of course, he finished, these clues must also provide precisely the correct amount of information, so that the motive of the criminal is not only fulfilled, but exposed.
If not to one of the characters in the book, at least to the reader.
Mr. Wood relaxed and sipped his own drink. From somewhere aloft, a number of individually insignificant traces added up to fairly reliable evidence that Florence and Mrs. Wood were about to return. I gathered that the cross-questioning had allayed any parental suspicion.
I said, one thing you haven't mentioned, and paused for effect.
To the Hindu, perfection means the inclusion of an almost imperceptible flaw, so that its maker cannot be accused of presuming to be as good as God. Is your perfect crime to be perfect in the eyes of the criminal, or in the eyes of the police?
He said, Ah, Captain Schnell, that is indeed one of my bothersome problems.
Mrs. Wood came into the room, followed by Florence. The girl had lost the soaked gamin look. She was transformed by modern alchemy into a poised young woman who forced me to revise my estimated 18 several years upward. She nodded affably at her father, smiled at me, and then came over because she noticed that my highball glass was empty. I thanked her, and she smiled wide and bright as she asked, Has Daddy been giving you the details of his impossible bandit?
Well, in a way, Mr. Wood said, I'm sort of like the standard television father, incapable of adding two and two without the close supervision of the female members of my family.
We keep telling Daddy he should hire Superman for a hero.
You've changed, chuckled Mr. Wood.
Changed?
Yesterday you advocated that I hire a detective with telepathy and a sense of perception.
We discussed it on the way home, said Florence.
Superman? I asked.
No, this extrasensory business, said Florence.
Mr. Wood inquired, Are you interested in parapsychology, Captain Schnell?
I've been interested in the subject for a good many years, I answered.
Would the public accept it, I wonder, he mused.
Mrs. Wood said, A lot of people read psychic books.
Mr. Wood said plaintively, I don't want to write psychic books.
I want to write a whodunit.
But it would solve my problem, wouldn't it? My series would consist of crimes that would be perfect, except for the introduction of a master of psionics who tells the story in the first person singular and who solves the crime by his parapsychic power.
It might read better if you made your extrasensory character the criminal, I suggested.
He shook his head. Wouldn't do at all. A criminal with extrasensory talent would always win out over the police. There have been only a very few successful stories written in which the criminal got away.
Maybe he wouldn't, I said. But how could he possibly fail?
He might get sloppy.
Sloppy?
Mind reading every anticipated move?
Or bored?
Bored?
One often leads to the other, I told him with a smile. Which is just my policeman's way of thinking.
From the policeman's point of view, you're overlooking one rather important angle.
Indeed. Well, you must tell me all about it.
Okay, I said. My point is that you should not view this as a single incident in the life of an extrasensory who has turned his talent to crime, but rather take the overall view. For instance, we can write the life history of our Psi man in broad terms. As a schoolboy, he was considered extraordinarily lucky at games of chance and skilled in games of manual dexterity. He stood high in schoolwork and at the same time managed to do it without working very hard. By the time he enters high school, he realizes that his success is due to some sort of sensing of when things will be right. This increases the efficiency of his talent, and he surges forward and would have become top of class if he hadn't discovered that brilliance in recitation make up for the lack of handed-in homework. In other words, nothing stands as a real challenge to him. His talents surmount the obstacles that confront his fellow men. He could collect corporations or be a labor leader, president, or bum. Anything he wants can be gotten without much fuss. Our Psi man is primarily interested in a statistical income sufficient to support him to the dictates of his ambition. The trick is to achieve, say, 20 grand per annum, in such a way that the manipulation is never discovered. At first, our Psi man plans meticulously, but soon this process seems unnecessary, because the poor, ignorant homo saps don't even know they're being conned. He has no hard surface against which to wet his nervous edge, and so he begins to play games. He leaves clues, at first to ascertain the true level of his fellow man's intelligence and ability. Next, he leaves conflicting clues to see which way the poor dopes will jump. In a world that scoffs at parapsychic phenomena, he leaves clues to support the theory that only an extrasensory criminal could have done the dastardly deed. Will one of the ignorant apes recognize the truth? If he does, will he be in a high position, or will he be one of the diligent ones who fetch coffee for the guy in the upper office? If the work of a Psi man is recognized, how will our bright policeman go about it? And what will he do with the evidence after it's been shown to him? And so, Mr. Wood, our Psi man criminal has become bored because there is no one in the world to challenge him, and he gets sloppy through his growing contempt for the ant-like activities of his fellow creatures. At last, he shows himself, deliberately taunting them to take action against him. And that, I concluded with a nod at him, might be the perfect crime in which your extrasensory criminal finally exposes himself. But why, Mrs. Wood asked in perplexity, would such a talented person turn to crime? Or do you think that all extrasensory people? I turned to smile at her. Mrs. Wood, I was not speaking of extrasensory people as a statistical body. I was referring to one particular character.
I find him hard to believe in.
On the contrary, my dear, said Mr. Wood, Captain Schnell has drawn an amazingly accurate thumbnail sketch of our Psi man, and I dare say that he could go on and on, filling in more minute details. Oh, yes, indeed, I said, but I must leave it up to the professional writer to tell what the brilliant policeman does when he recognizes the work as that of an extrasensory. For instance, does he become bold enough to mention it to Chief Weston or to Commissioner Stone, or will he confine his discussion to the company of a rain-soaked young woman so circumstantially available and coincidentally willing to discuss psionics?
Captain Schnell, breathed Florence Wood, what on earth are you talking about?
"Your father," I said. Mr. Woods stepped into the breach. "Captain Chanel was dramatizing for your benefit, I'm sure, because Captain Chanel knows very well how impossible it is to surprise a telepath into revealing himself." Florence Wood's expression changed to a mildly bothered smile.
"It certainly sounded as if he were accusing you of something."
"You mean like mind reading?" he asked with a big belly laugh that closed the subject. By most of the rules of society, both Mr. Wood and I were guilty of gross gentility. He greeted me overtly as the welcome guest and needled me with a show of patronizing tolerance as he implied that my basic interest was in Florence. To match him, I accepted his hospitality and made use of the proximity to spy upon him and his family. There are ways and means of making a pretended deaf-mute reveal himself. The human being does not live who will not leap halfway out of his skin at the shock of an unexpected revolver shot, no matter how well-trained he is at feigning deafness. As for surprising a telepath, I knew it wouldn't work. But I had to try it anyway. I put both Mrs. Wood and Florence through a number of mental hurdles. To this, Mr. Wood took a quietly tolerant attitude. He understood and was prepared to accept as healthily normal a certain amount of lust and carnal conjecture in the minds of males who were interested in his daughter. He forgave me mentally, insulting his wife, because he knew that my mental peregrinations were only aimed at determining whether his wife was telepathic. Finally, he came out flatly and told me to stop wasting my effort because neither Florence nor Mrs. Wood had a trace of extrasensory power. Their lack of shocked or outraged response was not a case of the well-trained telepath divining my intention and planning a blank response. Furthermore, Mr. Wood asserted that neither of them knew of his extrasensory facility, that he fully intended to keep it that way, and that I should know damned well that such stunts wouldn't work in the first place. And so I continued to enjoy a dinner now and then, and occasionally the company of Florence. Ultimately, the lack of progress brought Chief Weston's nervous system to the blow-up point. He called me in, and I went, knowing the trouble cannot always be avoided, and when it can't, it's just plain sense to kick it out the props and have done with it. He plowed right in. "And what in the hell have you been doing?" "Chief, I've been..." "You put a make team on some half-baked writer named Wood?"
"Edward Hazlitt."
"Because," he yelled, "the first person you saw when you stuck your head outside of Gordon Andrews' apartment was Florence Wood."
"Well, Chief, you see,
you perhaps suspected that she just walked through the wall of the apartment, and naturally you pulled out your hip pocket crime laboratory and checked that umbrella tip for bloodstains before you threw it aside."
"Well, you see, Chanel, would you have been so damn gallant if she'd been an ugly old hag in a ratty dress carrying a dead halibut wrapped in an old newspaper?
But you see, so you leap into gallant action, and after you've rescued the fair maiden from her watery grave, you suddenly find it desirable to use a department automobile to deliver the damsel home?
But, Chanel, I'll bet that Wood girl wasn't any wetter than you were.
And that's how you put the long arm of coincidence to work?"
Please join me next week for part two of The Undetected by George O. Smith. But I bet you knew I was going to say that. On Astounding Stories of Space and Time. Until then, watch the skies. Thank you.